It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
So, plenty to cover this week. Let's start with national, if that's okay. And it looks like the Senate is not going to be doing a full inquiry into the wiretaps.
Yeah, this is astonishing. Republicans not wanting to investigate Republicans. Who would have thunk? Fairly conservative Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas controls the Senate Intelligence Committee, ironically named though that is. And they voted this week basically to kill the Senate's investigation of the NSA's warrantless domestic spying scandal, even though, you know, everybody outside the White House, essentially, who's a legal expert, has called it illegal, and a lot of people have called it an impeachable offense. What they did instead is actually far worse than just not investigating. At the behest of the White House, which put apparently a tremendous amount of pressure on moderate Republicans like Chuck Hagel and of Nebraska and Olympia Snowe of Maine to go along with this. So it was a straight party line vote. And what's going to wind up happening, because there's a companion bill sponsored by Republican Mike DeWine of Ohio, who's up for re-election, and hopefully Sherrod Brown will kick his puny little butt. But what they've done is they're setting up a 7-person subcommittee for quote-unquote oversight, except it doesn't really have any of the program, but it doesn't really have any oversight. The White House doesn't have to tell the Senate for 45 days about any wiretap targets or programs that they're engaging under the DeWine bill, and it included a provision that actually expands the scope of the NSA spying program. It's now broadened to include anyone who, quote, works in support of a terrorist group or organization. Well, that could be anything from somebody who sends aid to Palestine, since the government of the Palestinian Authority is controlled by Hamas, who the U.S. considers a terrorist organization. Given that you have people in the administration who quite seriously consider any critic of the administration to be aiding and abetting the terrorists, you could even see them stretching the language to include administration critics and people who have facts that happen to run contrary to the fantasy world some of these people live in. And we've seen before that this White House in particular stretches the language quite a bit when it comes to interpreting how far and how extensive its own power can go. So it's a very, very worrisome development that's been being rammed through the Senate by the Republicans. At the same time, the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York have separately filed injunctions in two different federal courts to try and halt the NSA spying program. That was this week. There have also been several lawsuits that have already been filed by people who have good reason to believe for one reason or another that they've been victimized by this NSA monitoring program, and also by various defendants who've been convicted of crimes related to terrorism, saying that that evidence was obtained illegally. So the courts are going to rule on this. Now, whether the courts, particularly the Supreme Court, has been stacked with enough Republican appointees to whitewash this or not is an open question. But the courts are definitely going to have to look at this because Congress will not.
And related to that, I saw an article this week about the FBI wiretaps that they were found by an investigation that they were breaking their own policies in terms of wiretaps.
Yeah, I think 100 different cases were found where the FBI was not following its own guidelines vis-a-vis wiretaps and domestic surveillance. At the same time, the Pentagon, I think, was in the news this week for its domestic spying guidelines or criteria that it took the names out of the various activists, the famous Quakers in Lake Worth, Florida, and the various other groups, including the folks who here in Seattle who were potentially going to be protesting CFAIR, and in some cases actually protesting CFAIR. Those names have been supposedly purged from the Pentagon database right now, and you have the Pentagon with the in the curious situation of saying, yeah, you're right, they shouldn't have been in our database of foreign terrorists, but not saying anything about whether they should have been monitored in the first place under suspicion of being terrorists. So chances are very good that type of monitoring is still going on, just as a heads up to any, you know, activists out there.
All right. Well, and
we wouldn't want to give away any state secrets by, you know, letting enemies of the state know that they're being monitored.
That's right. The House torpedoed food labels this week.
Yeah, really bad news. This has not gotten very much publicity. It's something called the National Uniformity for Food Act, and it's something basically being rammed through by big agribusiness and large food corporations that are outraged that California and other states and localities have been starting to pass laws. In California, it was an initiative that have much stricter labeling requirements for foods, and for example, it has to do with organics. Of course, there's already a federal law that prohibits mentioning whether there's genetically modified organisms in the food or whether you can use bovine horse hormone or anything like this. This is another very similar kind of thing where states under this regulation will not be allowed to have labeling requirements that are more strict than the federal labeling requirements, which are virtually nil. And under the federal requirements, which are basically written by industry, we don't really know what's going into our commercially grown food. That's one reason why a lot of people in the past few years have been turning to organically grown food, aside from the fact that it's more nutritious and tastes better. And I can attest to that perfectly because I've been eating organics for the last 10 years or so. This, again, is just really symptomatic of how Congress and the White House also, for that matter, are really captives of special interests, really captives of, you know, big corporate interests that are lining campaign pockets. The vote on the House vote on the National Uniformity for Food Act was 283-139. So a lot of Democrats went along with this, too, and they shouldn't have. This will go to the Senate right now. Probably a good idea to get a hold of Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray both and urge them to oppose this. I don't know how successful that will be, but bear in mind that a lot of Democrats in the House supported this, so their opposition is not something that can be taken for granted at all. And this is being sold, amazingly enough, in Congress as something that's supposed to benefit consumers because this way we won't be confused, as though we're too stupid to understand the garbage that's being poured into our commercial food.
Oh, we won't be confused because we'll be zombies from all the toxins that we'll be taking in.
Yeah, that's true, too.
But it was my understanding, and I might have gotten this mixed up with something else, but that there were 39 states that as well that opposed this bill.
Yeah. It was very
attorney generals.
And it's also a states' rights issue because, you know, states should have the right to regulate their marketplace. But, you know, it's not necessarily anything that's crossing state lines, so it's not interstate commerce. This is a piece of legislation that is being written by and for industry and is really, really bad for you and I.
All right, moving along, the Supreme Court this week said that recruiters can go to college.
Yeah, this was not a big surprise. The Supreme Court voted to uphold a law that bans college campuses or other campuses from banning military recruiters on campus if they get federal dollars. If they want to have the ban, fine, but they won't get any federal dollars. This is very similar to laws that we've seen in the past that, for example, tie student aid to draft registration and take away student aid if you've had any drug convictions and so forth. It's basically social engineering of young people, and in this case, it's overriding a lot of campuses' concerns that campuses have things in their bylaws prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. And of course, the military discriminates on the basis of sexual orientation. That's the basis by which a lot of campuses, which are not necessarily opposed to the foreign policy of the U.S. per se, have had concerns about military recruiters. And of course, we've had all kinds of scandals over the last year or two, you know, and probably a lot of these practices go a lot farther back than that, over recruiters misrepresenting themselves, misrepresenting the armed forces, going to great lengths, you know, rigging drug tests and things like that to try and get young people into the army. There is a huge burgeoning counter-recruitment movement in this country. When you hear pundits say that there's no anti-war movement in this country, that's very wrong. What people are doing with the Iraq War is not marching in the streets. They are going everywhere that military recruiters go and saying, don't join the army. And between those efforts and the general unpopularity of the war in Iraq, you know, those are the two biggest reasons why military recruiting is down so much. I think 42% was the last figure that I saw. You know, the Army in particular, and also the Marines, are getting nowhere near hitting their recruiting goals. And I mean, this movement has really made an impact on what the armed forces in this country can do. And this is part of the whole blowback from that.
In fact, they keep raising their limits on, for instance, the age of people that they take in. I think they'll take like up to 42-year-olds now.
Yeah,
or 39.
Exactly.
Before we move on,
and also lowering the standards that the people have to meet in order to get in.
Before we move on to international, I just wanted to squeeze in that I saw an article as well in today's paper that they'd had the largest spill ever on the Alaskan North Slopes oil spill.
Yeah, I'm glad the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge would be safe for oil drilling.
Yeah, 200, somewhere between, they're estimating currently, between 200,000 and 270,000 gallons of oil from a ruptured pipe.
And don't forget that I believe it was the Interior Department that has control over this under the blessedly departing Gail Norton, although I'm sure whoever they bring in will be just as bad as she was, that the National Petroleum Reserve, which is a huge chunk of land west of Prudhoe Bay, west of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, is being opened up to oil drilling. That was the response of the administration when the ANWR drilling was spiked. So you are going to get, and it's just as pristine, just as wild as ANWR is, so you are going to get a big chunk of wilderness in Alaska being subjected to this kind of oil drilling in the relatively near future.
All right, let's move on to international, starting with Iraq.
A lot going on in and about Iraq this week. Amnesty International and the U.S. State Department both came out with reports. I wrote a column for WorkingForChange.com on Wednesday that linked to the Amnesty report and talked about it, saying a couple things. Number one, that the United States and Great Britain are engaging currently, not just with Abu Ghraib, but ever since Abu Ghraib, including right now, in gross violations of human rights. They were particularly concerned about two things. They were concerned about detentions. There were upwards of 14,000 Iraqis who were being held in various prisons in Iraq without any due process, without being charged with any crime. A lot of these young Sunni men who have been caught up in neighborhood sweeps of areas where the military believes insurgents are hiding out. They don't necessarily have anything to do with the insurgency. They haven't committed any crime, but they're left in limbo. Amnesty compared the situation that they're in to Guantanamo Bay, both for the lack of due process and for the grotesque conditions under which they're being held and the human rights abuses therein. They also talked a lot about torture. The quote from Amnesty's UK director was something along the line of reports of torture continue to pour out of Iraq. And those aren't so much the occupation forces anymore. It's the Shiite-controlled government of Iraq, and particularly the Interior Ministry, which is very closely linked to the Badr Brigade, which is the private militia of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which is the largest of the fundamentalist Shiite political parties that controls the Iraqi government. So the Interior Ministry is really pretty closely tied to the highest levels of Iraqi government. We had the director of the Baghdad morgue fleeing the country this past week after revealing that execution-style murders of young Sunni men are far more extensive than previously known, that many hundreds come into just the Baghdad morgue, not even other cities around the country, but just in Baghdad, many hundreds of young Sunni men who come in bound, often with police handcuffs, shot in the back of the head, hundreds per week, many thousands overall, because this has been going on for months and months and months, probably close to a year, if not more. So Amnesty was rightly concerned about this as well. And, you know, this couldn't be happening if the Shiite government, which was put into power by the United States, basically, and by the system that the United States set up, they're still very dependent on the U.S. and on U.S. The U.S. military, the economic aid that's being provided by the U.S. The Washington D.C. could stop this if they wanted to, but at this point, so far, it's not happening. And similarly, there was a report in the State Department this week talking about some of these same issues. They're becoming fairly widely known, and the Iraqi government is not such as it is because actually the new government from the December 15th elections hasn't been formed yet, but the government that's now in place has been doing nothing about them. We also learned this week that the Shiite government ordered an undercount of the dead, the people that died in the sectarian violence following the bombing of the shrine in Samarra on February 22nd. By most outside reports, something like 1,400 or more people around the country died in that wave of violence. The official death toll from the government of Iraq is 379, and apparently the health ministry, which is also controlled by the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, gave out orders to morgues and other places not to report those dead because they didn't want the bad publicity. We had the announcement this week by the United States that Abu Ghraib prison is going to close. If you remember, in 2004, after the first of those dreadful photos came out, President Bush promised that the United States would close Abu Ghraib prison as a symbol of the horrors that took place there, both under the U.S. and under Saddam Hussein. Well, that's not exactly what's happening. What's happening is that Abu Ghraib is in a neighborhood that is no longer secure enough for the trucks and other things, both ferrying prisoners and also, you know, making deliveries of food and other logistics back and forth to that neighborhood. It's not safe anymore for those deliveries to take place. So they want to move the prisoners to a place presumably closer to the green zone that would be more secure. They are not going to tear down Abu Ghraib prison. They're going to turn it over to the Iraqi government, the same Iraqi government that's engaging in mass torture and mass death squad execution activity right now. So, you know, draw your own conclusions from that. But once again, many Iraqis remember that promise that Abu Ghraib was going to be torn down. And the United States seems to be oblivious to that and oblivious to what Abu Ghraib means symbolically to Iraqis and, for that matter, to Muslims all through the Islamic world. Finally, we had one other interesting court case this week. The first of the contractors that has been accused of fraud and corruption in conjunction with the no-bid contracts that were let to the Coalition Provisional Authority when the United States was directly running Iraq in 2003-2004, went to trial this past week, and a company named Custer Battles, which was formed by former military people in 2002 and magically got the contract in 2003 to provide Iraq with a new currency. Well, they're going to have to pay $10 million for essentially defrauding the CPA and the American taxpayers. That was actually only a tiny amount of the money that they raked in, but the problem was the CPA is such an ambiguous legal entity that it's hard to prove how much of the money for running the CPA came from American taxpayers and how much came from other sources. So they were only nicked for the $10 million. It could have been a lot more, but the principals, again, are facing criminal charges as well, and this is just the first of a number of cases, none of them involving Halliburton, at least yet. Of course, the Pentagon whitewashed that a couple of weeks ago, but we're going to start to see criminal cases of just how bad the corruption and fraud and overcharging of the American taxpayer has been during the occupation of Iraq.
Moving on to Iran.
Iran also, a lot happened this week. The International Atomic Energy Agency had a meeting on Monday at which it made the final decision under great pressure from the United States to refer Iran's noncompliance with the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty to the UN Security Council. Now, John Bolton at the UN, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, who was put in there by Bush after Congress wouldn't approve him, so he's actually got to be reapproved by Congress later this year. But he was waxing this week about the need to invade Iran, and he was not the only one. You had Britain now claiming that Iran, rather than being 5 to 10 years away from a nuclear weapon, well, that doesn't sound scary enough. That isn't going to get the public concerned enough, because 5 to 10 years away is a long time. You know, there might be time for diplomacy or something like that. So now the formulation is, and listen to this closely, that Iran could, quote, acquire the technological capacity to build a bomb by the end of the year. Well, the technological capacity to build a bomb doesn't say anything about whether they even want to build a bomb, let alone whether they're trying to, let alone how long it's going to take. But what people are going to hear from that is by the end of the year, which cuts down remarkably the amount of time that's available for diplomatic solutions. There's a real strong, concerted push here for military action against Iran. The UN Security Council is going to be asked to pass sanctions. China and Russia are going to refuse. But now that the IAEA has referred it to the Security Council, that's the legitimacy that the U.S. Is going to use, and the Israel is going to use to claim the military strike is justified. You had all sorts of people in the Bush administration this week making essentially military threats or making reference to the possibility of a military strike against Iran. It wasn't just John Bolton. Dick Cheney also did it. Donald Rumsfeld also did it. You had a very blunt threat of military action from the Israeli government. So this is really ramping up right now, and people need to pay attention to this. Talk to folks about how dangerous a military strike on Iran would be, the probability that it would lead to a wider regional war. Just it's a really bad idea. But for whatever reasons, they seem to be full bore ahead going forward with this. It's very frightening.
Had an excellent piece on alternative radio this morning from 6 to 7, Noam Chomsky, talking about Iran as well. So people can get that off our archives, of mm-hmm. course, for the next 2 weeks. Anything else on Iran?
No, that was it.
Okay. I think that then moves us back to local.
Yes.
Okay. Well, looks like the viaduct is going to the voters.
Yeah, it does. One of the things that the state legislature in Olympia did before it closed up shop this week was pass legislation that essentially demanded that the city of Seattle make up its mind on what to do with the Alaskan Way Viaduct. It got referred to the city council, and the city council has two choices. It can make a recommendation itself before November, or it can ask city voters to make a recommendation before November. The city council, which incidentally went for the tunnel option 2 years ago by an 8-1 vote. There are a couple more votes now that might feel differently. David Della, for example, has changed his mind and said he wants the viaduct rebuilt. But by and large, the council knows where it stands, but for political reasons, it's much more likely to refer the matter to voters. So it's almost certainly going to be on the ballot. At least two options, either rebuilding the viaduct or building a tunnel, and hopefully a third of just keeping Alaska Way Viaduct as an at-grade boulevard on the waterfront and not rebuilding a freeway at all, either above ground or below ground. I mean, that was what San Francisco did with the Embarcadero Freeway after it collapsed in the 1989 earthquake, and it worked so well for San Francisco that they've done the same thing now with the Central Freeway on the western edge of downtown. So it can work with that option, and hopefully we'll be able to consider it. But at least those two options are going to be there. And you know, for my money, if you're going to rebuild the freeway, which I think is essential for traffic, you know, no matter how you don't like cars, gridlock is bad for the environment too, and we're going to have to rebuild I-5 through Seattle at some point in the coming years as well. If you're going to rebuild the freeway, it makes all kinds of sense to do it underground and open up the waterfront. The waterfront could be a really good investment in the economy of this city, and you know, particularly if it's not given over to private developers, but it's at least some of it is maintained as a public space. You know, not what's happened at the north end of Alaska Way, where the SR-99. Curves away from the waterfront, and you have the new convention center, the new cruise ship terminal, and all the various condos, but keeping it for the public. That could be a good thing. But that's going to go to the voters in November. We're going to hear a lot more about that.
All right. Well, let's talk about some events this weekend. If we got time, then we'll come back to some stories.
Yeah, there's a lot going on today and this weekend, particularly today. The Northwest Sustainability Conference actually started yesterday, but is going on all day today. It's $30 for one-day registration. That's at the Mountaineers Conference Center at 300 3rd Avenue West. Starts at 9 a.m., so if you want to get over there at 9 o'clock, Dean and Lyons, the folk singer from Bellingham is I don't know if he's keynoting or if he's performing or what he's going to do, but he's presenting to the large group at 9 o'clock, so that'll be pretty cool. Veg Fest for you vegetarians out there is going on today and tomorrow also. That's from 10 to 6 o'clock at the Seattle Center Exhibition Hall. That's only $5, so that's cheap to get into, and there'll be a lot of vendors and a lot of good food ideas there. A couple different protests happening today. In Tacoma, folks are gathering at 11 o'clock at the Northwest Detention Center gathering to protest the Pacific Northwest National Security Forum, which is a lot of generals and military folks getting together and talking about where the U.S. can invade in the future, basically. They're going to be marching at 11 o'clock with a rally. Noon, they're going to march from the detention center to the downtown Sheraton. That's where the Pacific Northwest National Security Forum will be meeting. Also,
and for those of you unfamiliar with the detention center, that's at 1623 East J Street in Tacoma.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I should have said that. We also have today the Rally for Marriage Equality, a rally basically in anticipation of the upcoming state Supreme Court ruling on the legality of the Defense of Marriage Act. That's going to be a march from Seattle Central Community College at noon. 1 o'clock, there will be a rally at Westlake Park. And this evening, Rachel Corrie's parents are in town, the young woman who was murdered by Israeli Defense Forces, the Israeli military, when she was trying to defend the home of a Palestinian family that was being torn down. They are going to be in town talking about their recent trip to Israel in the occupied territories. That is going to be at 3 o'clock this afternoon at Consolidated Works, 500 Boren Avenue, 500 Boren Avenue North, I'm sorry. And that'll be free of charge. And then finally, it isn't this weekend, but it'll be coming up next Friday. And this is actually highly recommended. Wangari Maathai, who's the Kenyan environmentalist, a woman who is recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004. She will be in town Friday at as part of Foolproof's American Voices series at Benaroya Hall, and she is really one of the most prominent voices for environmentalism, for Africa, for women's rights, for human rights. She's just a remarkable, remarkable woman, so check her out when she comes to town.
All right. Talking once again with John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It is a free local newspaper that covers local as well as national and international news and events. And we have comics and humor and all that. It's a volunteer enterprise. So all of us who help put it out do it as kind of a labor of love. It's been going for a decade now. So we can always use volunteers to help distribute it, to write, to edit, to proofread, to sell ads, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you are interested in that, or if you want to donate, or if you have comments, of feedback, tips, anything in the paper, anything you've heard from this show, you can go to our website and contact us through there. We also have all of our back issues there. It's at www.eatthestate.org, and we also have a blog with a lot of ongoing things from day to day. You can also call our voicemail, and that number is area code 206-719-6947.